I'm Marty Moscowane, and this is Radio Times in Review, a new show where we dig into the Radio Times archives and find some of the best interviews from the past. First up today, we listen to my 2010 interview with Jonathan Eig, author of Get Capone, the secret plot that captured America's most wanted gangster. His book is a lengthy profile of the notorious mob boss in which he debunks many of the long-standing myths surrounding Capone, who died of a syphilis-related stroke 68 years ago. Let's listen. Well, let's go back to the beginning of Al Capone's life. He was born in 1899, the fourth of nine kids, grew up in Brooklyn.
That's right, just like me, Brooklyn boy.
Oh, is that right?
Yeah.
And a sixth grade dropout.
That's right. Some people say he dropped out after beating up his teacher. Al dropped out because he wanted to help support his family. He always put a good spin on things.
Which do you think is true?
I think it's possible that he was telling the truth in this case. I think the teacher who told the story about being beat up, I believe, may have mistaken him with another gangster, believe it or not.
Wow.
So I think it's possible that Capone did drop out mostly to help raise his family. Not that he was a choir boy. He got into lots of trouble as a young man and as a boy even. By the time he was 17 or 18, he was working in a very tough bar on Coney Island where he was meeting a lot of these underworld figures who would really become his mentors.
You describe, and I don't know how common this was, that he actually contracted syphilis as a young man.
Yes, and it was fairly common back then. And he contracted it in his early 20s, maybe even his late teens, and he decided not to seek treatment for it. There was a treatment at the time, and it was fairly reliable, and it probably would have prevented him from having any further troubles. But he did not seek treatment, and it went away, and then many years later came back to haunt him in a terrible way.
How would you describe, then, the adult Al Capone?
I would describe Capone as an ambitious man, certainly, a man capable of great violence, but also a man capable of charm. He was a jovial person, and if you were on his good side, he was a pleasure to be around. He was a likable man in many ways.
And how did one get on Al Capone's bad side?
By doing business with one of his rivals, or by trying to undercut him on price, or by trying to horn in on his territory. You know, this prohibition made these guys incredibly rich. These two-bit thugs suddenly had incredible wealth at their disposal. The cops were no problem because they could be bought. The only problem was competition. So if you decided that you were going to try to compete with this guy, you were opening up a big can of worms.
If we hadn't had prohibition, would we have had an Al Capone, do you think?
No, without a doubt, he would have been nothing. We never would have heard of the guy. He would have been a longshoreman or a truck driver. Maybe at best he would have owned a small chain of stores somewhere if he'd cleaned up his act. No, he was a guy who was perfectly suited for the moment when Prohibition came along because he knew the beer business. He was not afraid of breaking heads when he had to. And he had this personal charm that I think was really important in helping him build this network that was so key to his success. He was not the kind of guy who ran every detail of the operation, but he knew how to network. And he also loved celebrity, so he became this international icon because he couldn't shut up when the reporters came around. So the timing was a perfect storm for Capone to get rich and famous thanks to Prohibition.
And thanks to the press, as you write. I mean, it seems as if the press loved Capone just because he was great copy for them.
Yeah, that's exactly right. You know, who wouldn't love this guy? You know, he's breaking the law and talking about it openly. He and all his men have these great nicknames. They're gregarious. They're fun to hang out with. They're at the track so the reporters can go at the track and interview him anytime they want. You know, this was a journalist's dream, and you know, I had tabloids at the time getting started all over America, and they were in love with these characters, and they couldn't get them in the paper enough. This really sold newspapers. And, of course, the murders sold newspapers, too, and these guys were always killing each other off, so it was a good deal all around for the newspaper reporters.
Well, I have a quote here from Al Capone, I believe telling a reporter, he said, I violate the prohibition law. Sure, who doesn't? The only difference is I take more chances than the man who drinks a cocktail before dinner and a flock of highballs after it. Is that kind of quintessential Al Capone?
That is quintessential Capone, and it also happens to be 100% true. And that explains a lot of why he was tolerated as much as he was in Chicago. It would have been hypocritical for Chicagoans to say this guy is a demon when they were all drinking his booze. He was a key supplier.
But this was a brutal man, yes?
Without a doubt.
And brutal, I guess, more to his competitors or his enemies as he saw them?
Yes, that's right. He wasn't the kind of guy who was splitting heads of people. He just looked at him the wrong way. It was all about the business for him, and he talked about that. He even said, why do we have to kill people in this business from time to time? Well, maybe it's to protect our interests. Maybe it's to take care of our families and to make sure that somebody doesn't kill me before I can kill him. So, you know, he took a pragmatic view of it, but nevertheless, he had made a decision that he was willing to commit these kinds of acts or to order them done. And in most cases, certainly after he became well-established and after he became famous, he kept his own hand free of blood, and he ordered these hits when necessary.
And he seemed to have, as much as he gave, as he bribed cops and other members of law enforcement, he seemed to have no respect for them for accepting those bribes.
Yeah, that's right. He said that he always felt like the only thing lower than a criminal, than a bootlegger, was a politician or a public servant who accepts bribes from them. And he said, you know, I buy those men like I'd buy any other item, and I have no respect for them whatsoever.
And I mentioned the fact that Capone was arrested and jailed here in Philadelphia at Eastern State Penitentiary. What was he doing in Philadelphia?
Yeah, it was interesting. He was in Atlantic City for a gang leader summit. This was one of the first times, perhaps the first time, that all of America's top gangsters came together for a meeting to talk about their efforts, to talk about how they can better coordinate. In some cases, I think they were talking about the embarrassment that Capone was bringing on them because he was acting so recklessly in Chicago and inviting so much publicity, and they were sick of him putting himself in the headlines all the time. So they all came together in Atlantic City. Capone was then on his way back to Chicago. He was going to take a train from New York when his car broke down, and he ended up taking a commuter train to Philadelphia, and he planned to go from Philadelphia back to Chicago, but he had time for a movie in between, and went to see a movie in downtown Philadelphia, and while there, he was arrested by some Philadelphia police officers for possession of a weapon. They found him with a gun in his pocket. So in less than a day, in only 13 hours, Philadelphia's judicial system managed to do what Chicago had not been able to do for a decade. They convicted and sentenced Al Capone to jail and gave him 1 year in prison for weapons possession.
So how did this guy, this U.S. attorney, George E.Q. Johnson, how did he build his case against Al Capone?
Very slowly, actually. He was a very deliberate guy. He was really not cut out for this kind of work. He was a guy who liked the theater, and he looked a little bit like a poet, and he had very little background as a criminal prosecutor. So this order comes from Herbert Hoover, the president, all the way on high to get Capone, and George Johnson is proceeding very deliberately. He's trying to build a case that is bulletproof here. He's looking at bootlegging charges. He's looking at contempt of court charge because Capone was refusing to appear in court on an unrelated matter. Finally, he begins looking at income tax evasion just because he's had some success going after some of the lesser gangsters on tax charges. It's very hard to build a case against these guys because they do all their business in cash. They don't use banks. They don't use checks. They don't keep lists of their assets anywhere. Even the prohibition charges are difficult to make because, you know, when you break down the doors of a distillery or a brewery or a speakeasy, it's very hard to prove the ownership. Capone owned nothing. He owned none of these businesses. Finally, he settles on this income tax evasion charge, and even then he moves so slowly that the feds are just going crazy. What's taken this guy so long?
But, you know, here Capone, he was so brazen. He was so bold about his enterprise, what he was doing, the fact that he was breaking the law, and including the fact that this was a violent enterprise. It's just so curious that there wasn't enough evidence to build that case against him, that the U.S. attorney had to look at tax evasion.
It really is shocking. Here's a guy who admits he's a bootlegger, and he's rubbing it in the face of the federal government every day, saying, sure, I sell booze to these people. That's what they want, and somebody's got to give it to them. And yet they couldn't put him away for it because the businesses were not in his name, and he hired people to do all the dirty work for him. And they would have to get someone basically to flip on Capone, and they'd have to get somebody to testify and say, Capone is my boss, and I'm selling booze for him, and here's how we can prove it. But that would have been a near impossibility. Nobody was going to rat on Al Capone.
The indictment stated that Capone had earned a net income of $123,101.89. This is 1924, and failed to pay taxes on that amount. Taxes would have come to $32,489.24.
That's right. So we're not talking an astronomical amount.
No, we're not.
That's about $1 million by today's accounting. And Capone immediately offered to settle the case. He said, okay, let's make a deal. Let's pay. Tell me what I owe, and I'll take care of this. But by that point, the Fed said, no, we're not looking to collect taxes from you at this point. We're looking to build a case. They actually used his admission that he was willing to pay taxes as an admission of guilt, and they used that as evidence against him when they did go to trial.
Did Al Capone have a fair trial?
No, he did not. And the irony is that he probably shouldn't have had a trial at all because Capone and the U.S. attorney agreed on a deal, a 2.5-year plea bargain. And all the way up to the attorney general's office, all the way up to the White House, everybody signed off on this deal, 2.5 years for Capone. And Capone was bragging about it. I can do 2.5 years. He was only 32 years old at that point. When the judge got wind of this, that Capone was bragging about it, he pulled the deal and insisted on a trial. And then the judge went about really fixing the trial to make sure Capone had no chance.
How did he do that?
Well, first he brought in a new jury. Capone had been trying to bribe the jurors. So the judge got rid of the panel of prospective jurors that they'd been working with and brought in his own. And this was not just a random jury, and it was certainly not a jury of Capone's peers. These were all older men from rural Cook County. They were farmers. In fact, Damon Runyon, who was covering the trial, said that the courtroom smelled of rutabagas and turnips every time the jury walked in.
Wow, I just have to savor that for a second. That's wonderful.
Yeah. The other thing is that the judge picked jurors who he had worked with before on other bootlegging cases, including some of whom had served on Al Capone's grand jury. So he knew these were men who were prepared to convict the bootleggers. So it was a jury of the opposite of Capone's peers. This was a jury of the judge's friends and allies, in a way. And then the judge went about dismissing every objection that Capone's lawyers could come up with. The trial was highly unusual.
Now, he was released. He served almost the 11 years, right?
He served 8 out of the 11.
And released for good behavior.
That's right. He had an almost perfectly clean prison record.
And so where did he spend his final days?
He spent most of his time in Miami, where he bought a home on Palm Island. And he did return to Chicago a few times to visit his mother, and also went to the family's vacation home in Wisconsin. But he kept a low profile. He really stayed out of the spotlight almost entirely. And I think part of that is because his mind was gone. One of his partners in the business, Jack Greasy Thumbs Guzik, went to visit him in Miami and declared Capone nutty as a fruitcake.
Wow.
He would spend most of his time just hitting tennis balls into a net over and over, seemingly like a child in his behavior. He liked to go to the candy shop and load up on gum and candy and just sit around the house, apparently delusional, you know, worried that every car that came down the block was someone gunning for him and afraid that a machine gun was going to poke out the window. But in fact, he didn't die any kind of a dramatic death like that. He died slowly wasting away.
I mean, it sounds like a slow decompensation from the syphilis.
A horrible death.
And he died young. He was 48 years old.
Yeah, he was a young man. He was, you know, at the peak of his powers. He was 28, 29 years old. This was a man who really achieved worldwide fame, you know, instantly recognizable before he was 30 years old.
Who went to his funeral?
Nobody, really. A few reporters. His brother drove his body back up to Chicago from Florida, and they had to beg a priest even to perform the ceremony as a favor to Capone's mother, who was a very religious woman. This priest agreed to do the ceremony, but it was a horribly cold day in Chicago, and they had to get reporters to help carry the coffin. There were so few people there.
That was my interview with Jonathan Eich, whose book Get Capone, The Secret Plot That Captured America's Most Wanted Gangster, chronicled the life and death of one of history's most infamous criminals. This is Radio Times in Review. I'm Marty Moscoen. When we get back, we'll revisit my conversation with prominent atheist Sam Harris. He joined me last year upon the release of his book, Waking Up, A Guide to Spirituality Without Religion. Stay with us. Welcome back to Radio Times in Review. I'm Marty Moscoen. When Sam Harris joined me on Radio Times last year, it was just after his controversial appearance on HBO's Real Time with Bill Maher, in which Harris and actor Ben Affleck got into a heated argument about Islam and extremism. Because of the high-profile nature of this confrontation, much of my interview was centered on Harris's view of Islam and his remarks on Real Time. But we also devoted a chunk of our interview to his book, Waking Up, A Guide to Spirituality Without Religion. The book is Harris's ode to the mysterious elements of our universe and an explainer on how to be a devout atheist while still marveling at the power of the inexplicable forces of the world. Let's listen to this portion of my interview. what you write about in this book, which has the word spirituality in it, and of course that's one of those very spongy words that can mean so many different things. What does that mean to you?
Well, the central experience is this phenomenon of self-transcendence, the fact that it's possible to experience your conscious life free of the feeling of being a self in the middle of consciousness. Most people are walking around feeling like they are a subject or a self inside their heads.
They're the star of their own movie.
Yeah,
right?
Yeah. But they don't. It's important to point out that we don't feel identical to our bodies in the world. We feel like we have bodies. We feel like we're riding around inside our bodies. And this is a kind of illusion. It doesn't make any sense neurologically. There's no place in the brain for your ego to be hiding. And it is an illusion that can be disconfirmed through introspection, techniques like meditation and psychedelics. So there are ways to perturb consciousness so that you no longer feel like this center, this experiencer in addition to the experience. And the self is a kind of painful illusion, and this pain motivates people in a variety of ways. And when they find this pain assuaged, in the context of religious ideas, they become mightily attached to those ideas. And so people in all faiths and none have glimpses of self-transcendence. They experience the loss of self, and they also experience very positive states like ecstasy and rapture and bliss. And they use these experiences to confirm the truth of their religious beliefs. So if a Christian feels rapture in church or a loss of a sense of self, he or she will almost always take this as data in favor of the truth of Christianity. This is God's grace, or this is Jesus somehow intruding into their life. But of course, Buddhists and Hindus and Muslims and atheists have these same experiences. So we know there's a deeper explanation. We're talking about the nature of human consciousness. So I'm arguing in the book that we have to do that in the context of science and 21st century rationality.
You also talk about the fact that you used ecstasy, mm-hmm. and that ecstasy was a real revelation to you. And you experienced things that you had not experienced before, including what felt like, at least as I read it, really intense feelings for other people.
Yeah, well, I would call it a feeling of unconditional love. It's exactly what Jesus apparently was talking about in the New Testament, that this experience of loving your neighbor as yourself and feeling that love was a state of being that was not contingent upon any personal history with a person. So you didn't have to have a good reason to love somebody.
You just love them.
Yeah, you just realize you want others to be happy, and you fall into a well of that well-wishing, and that is an overwhelming experience of goodwill toward others for no good reason, just because you want others to have their hopes and dreams realized. And it's the kind of experience that proves to you, if you've had it, that it is possible to be a much better person, mm-hmm. and a much wiser person and a much happier person than you have tended to be in the past.
But did you need ecstasy to realize that?
I think I did. I think if you had taught me how to meditate at that moment in my life, I think I was 18 at the time, I would have looked inside and not seen anything worth paying attention to. I didn't have the concentration. I didn't have the interest, frankly. I was very skeptical and very sure that there was no there when you're talking about religious experience. I think I would have been unavailable to the level of inquiry required to have this experience through another means. And that is the strength of psychedelics. And this was obviously something that happened in the 60s to many Westerners, and it's still happening to some degree, that psychedelics are the only thing, and you have to issue a lot of caveats here because there are risks with them, and they're different, and some I think are probably neurotoxic, and some can be very destabilizing. So you can't. I'm not just advocating that everyone go out and bomb their brains with drugs, but the psychedelics are the only means where you are absolutely guaranteed an effect. If you're given 100 micrograms of LSD,
you're gonna
have something's gonna happen. You're not something terrifying can happen, but boredom is not in the cards. And with meditation or yoga or some other discipline, depending on their aptitude or their interests, someone may come away just thinking that there's nothing to it. And that's psychedelics were very useful for me at the beginning.
And how about now? 20s. I mean, you end the book writing quite a bit about psychedelics with some of these caveats and concerns, but it seems like you're making an argument there for taking psychedelics more seriously.
Yeah, well, for their utility, personally, at a certain point, it's been many years since I've taken anything. It's been over a decade probably going on 2 decades since I've taken any psychedelics. So they serve their purpose, but then they no longer serve a purpose in my view. Or if it's a purpose, it's not a necessary one. And so meditation for me is a much more systematic and durably useful method. It doesn't have the downside of psychedelics.
Of course, yeah. Of course. About a minute before a second break here. So do you have a certain form of meditation that you do use, or something that you've made up that you have found helpful to you to get to that place?
Yeah, well, I discuss this in the book, but what I recommend to beginners certainly is a method called Vipassana, which is now often known as mindfulness practice, because mindfulness is the type of awareness recommended in this tradition of this Buddhist tradition of practice. And mindfulness is simply paying very close attention to the nature of experience. So you're just paying attention to sensations and moods and even thoughts themselves. But the crucial difference is that you're not merely thinking. You're not lost in thought. And the first thing you have to discover is that you spend virtually every waking moment of your life lost in thought, thinking without knowing that you're thinking. And
right.
That is,
it's like highway hypnosis or something. Right?
Yeah, and then that is the spell that has to be broken. You have to be able to see thoughts themselves as mere appearances in consciousness, and mindfulness is the tool that would allow you to do that.
I'd love to have you actually read a section from your book.
Sure.
And this is, I think it speaks for itself.
This is the opening of the chapter, The Riddle of the Self. I once spent an afternoon on the northwestern shore of the Sea of Galilee, atop the mount where Jesus is believed to have preached his most famous sermon. It was an infernally hot day, and the sanctuary where I sat was crowded with Christian pilgrims from many countries. Some gathered silently in the shade, while others staggered about in the sun, taking photographs. As I gazed at the surrounding hills, a feeling of peace came over me. It soon grew to a blissful stillness that silenced my thoughts. In an instant, the sense of being a separate self, an I or a me, vanished. Everything was as it had been, the cloudless sky, the brown hills sloping to an inland sea, the pilgrims clutching their water bottles. But I no longer felt separate from the scene, peering out at the world from behind my eyes. Only the world remained. The experience lasted just a few seconds, but it returned many times as I looked out over the land where Jesus is believed to have walked, gathered his apostles, and worked many of his miracles. If I were a Christian, I would undoubtedly have interpreted this experience in Christian terms. I might believe that I had glimpsed the oneness of God, or had been touched by the Holy Spirit. If I were a Hindu, I might think in terms of Brahman, the eternal self, of which the world and all individual minds are thought to be a mere modification. If I were a Buddhist, I might talk about the Dharmakaya of emptiness, in which all apparent things manifest as in a dream. But I'm simply someone who is making his best effort to be a rational human being. Consequently, I'm very slow to draw metaphysical conclusions from experiences of this sort. And yet, I glimpse what I would call the intrinsic selflessness of consciousness every day, whether at a traditional holy site, or at my desk, or while having my teeth cleaned. This is not an accident. I've spent many years practicing meditation, the purpose of which is to cut through the illusion of the self.
And again, Sam Harris reading a section from his book, Waking Up, A Guide to Spirituality Without Religion. I really liked that, only because you put yourself in where Jesus was and experienced something. You called it something else, but you acknowledge the fact that if you were a Christian, you might have had a Christian experience.
Yeah. Yeah. This, I think, defines the line between, as I would draw it, between spirituality and religion. Because with spirituality, you're making claims about human experience, and your own experience, and the possibilities, therefore, of human experience, and having experiences in meditation or on drugs or by some other method, certainly entitles us to do this. There's no question that experiences like self-transcendence and unconditional love are available, and millions of people have throughout history have experienced them. What these experiences don't entitle you to do is to make claims about the nature of the cosmos, mm-hmm. or the divine origin of certain books, or the virgin birth of certain people. These kinds of claims are they're metaphysical, they're historical, they trespass directly on the territory of science, and there's nothing you experience in the darkness of your closed eyes while meditating that gives you information about what happened before the Big Bang or what's going on. So if you experience unconditional love, many people then want to say in a religious frame of mind, whether they're religious or New Age types like Deepak Chopra, that, well, this shows you that the energy of love pervades the cosmos, right? Well, it shows you nothing of the kind. It just shows you that this kind of experience is possible. And so the contact between spirituality and science is not where New Age types draw it, at spooky physics and quantum mechanics. It's at psychology and neuroscience and related fields that talk about the possibilities of human experience.
And you mentioned Deepak Chopra and the kind of New Age spiritualists. Mm. I mean, there are people that use that word spiritual who believe in past lives and crystals and all that. I mean, they're kind of intruding into your territory, aren't they?
Yeah, or I into theirs. So the problem for me is that there really is no good word in English to name this project. If you want to take seriously the claims of someone like Jesus or Buddha, and you want to see how far the contemplative life can go and explore the far end of on the positive continuum of human experience, you need a word like spirituality or mysticism use words like transcendence, because these experiences are there to be had. Mm-hmm. But again, these words are freighted with a lot of baggage, and you have to disavow the beliefs in Atlantis and all the rest.
But do you think that people that are capable of doing this kind of transcendent feeling, where you're feeling this oneness with the universe, perhaps out of your own ego, are they better people? Are they more moral people? Do they make more moral decisions than
people? That's a really good question, because certain of these states, I think, are ethically neutral, and so, which is to say that something like ecstasy or this feeling of meaning and purpose that can really take you out of yourself into a very expansive sense of self, this, I think, is ethically neutral, which is to say it can be pointed in the wrong direction. I think the bad boys who are getting off the bus in Syria right now to go join ISIS are experiencing very heightened states of mind. These aren't depressed people who went to the desert to die. These are people who believe they are fighting a cosmic battle against evil. And if you just listen to what they say about their experience and about their worldview, you have to recognize that this is a very energizing vision of life. They feel like spiritual James Bonds, right? Unhappy people.
But you're saying that they're taking this transcendent experience and turning into something
I wouldn't go so far as to say that they're cutting through the illusion of the self in precisely the way I describe in this book, but certainly feelings of ecstasy can take you in any possible direction. And they can take you to Burning Man, where you're just surrounded by naked people in day-glow body paint, or they can take you to jihad, or they can take you to something that's truly rational and benign or beneficial, which is the sort of thing I recommend in this book, which is a practice like mindfulness, where you can experience extraordinary changes in your consciousness without believing anything on insufficient evidence, and certainly without believing any divisive dogmas.
Are you a Buddhist?
I'm not. No. I think that to even be a Buddhist is to endorse a kind of religious sectarianism that is unsustainable. We don't have to pay lip service to these tribal identities. We simply have to talk about the nature of human consciousness.
You practice mindfulness or meditation, and it seems I'm very bad at doing things like that, but that we live in such an ADD culture, if I can say. I mean, there's so many things that are tugging at us and buzzers and beeps and things that are going off that are distracting us. How do you keep that away?
Yeah, well, it's hard. But the real obstacle is this habit of being lost in thought. So this meditation was hard 2,000 years ago. It didn't get much harder with the introduction of the iPhone.
Right.
It may be a little bit harder, but it's not. I think this technology cuts both ways. It's just amazing to me that no one ever gets lost in a city ever again because we have GPS on our phones. In a different time, I could have been wandering around Philadelphia trying to figure out how to get to the studio. So it's a in that sense, it's a kind of guardian of mindfulness, because there are certain things you don't have to worry about. But I think we have to carve out a space in our lives for silence, for contemplation, for a kind of profound engagement with the present moment. And so I think something like the Sabbath is a great idea. You know, I don't take one fully myself, but I think I should. I think I would be happier if I did. At certain points in my life, I have. You know, I spent something like 2 years on silent retreat in my 20s, in increments of 1 week to 3 months, and that was a Sabbath in a sense. And that's something that I certainly recommend to people who have the interest to do it, because there is nothing like being in silence.
I can't imagine.
It's an amazing privilege to be able to do that.
And that was my conversation with atheist Sam Harris, recorded last year. You're listening to Radio Times in Review. I'm Marty Moscow-Wayne. When we get back, we'll hear my 2010 interview with Danilo Perez. The acclaimed jazz pianist and composer was featured in a recent edition of the New York Times. It described his efforts using music to improve life in his native Panama, which includes a new live music venue with a populist mission. Stay with us. Welcome back to Radio Times in Review. I'm Marty Moscow-Wayne. The song you are currently hearing is the work of jazz composer Danilo Perez. The song, called Panama 500, gets its name from his native country, where he has recently opened a new live music venue with a populist bent. This effort was recently highlighted in a feature article in the New York Times. It described Perez's attempts to bring live music and spread musicianship to the Central American country, which includes his founding of the Panama Jazz Festival 12 years ago. We'll listen back to my 2010 interview with Perez, who joined me in studio just after his album Providencia had been nominated for a Grammy Award for Best Jazz Instrumental Album. Let's listen. You grew up in a clearly musical household.
Oh, since 2 years old, been recognizing the sounds, music. As a matter of fact, not only viewing music as music, but also as a tool to learn other courses like mathematics, geography. My mother and my father were educators, so they saw from the beginning, you know, reading, to read books, to all of that. But sometimes I didn't like certain courses, and my father would put music to so I could learn it.
Oh, is that right?
Oh yeah. So my relationship with music started very, very early, and he played guitar, played percussion. I was surrounded by records, by bongos, singing. Sometimes at breakfast, he would have me sing the second voice to this. I was like, oh, no, Daddy, not now. Yeah, yeah, sing Bésame Mucho, Bésame, Bésame. You know, and that's how I grew up with Papa, you know, it's intense relationship.
But I read that you actually got a BA in electronics.
Yeah.
I mean, did that have anything to do with music, or was that considered a fallback in case this music thing didn't work out?
Exactly that.
Is that right?
Yeah. It started that way, but it became my passion. And then it kind of, you know, you have to make deals with your mother, you know what I mean?
Is that right?
Of course.
So she was saying you need to get a degree so you can have a real job?
Exactly.
Oh, dear.
Just in case, you know, in our country, musicians, and a lot of places in Latin America and in the world, musicians are viewed as very undependable type of job. Except that I told my mother, I've never met a homeless musician, you know. They always find jobs everywhere. People always need music.
You grew up in Panama City.
Yes, I grew up.
And you were born in what, 65?
65, yeah. I grew up in Panama City, in the capital. I did some sort of homeschooling at home.
Oh, did you?
Yeah.
And who taught you?
My aunt, with my parents, of course. And then went to the normal schooling. I went to school. At 7 years old, I discovered the little keyboard that my uncle gave me, and I started playing Christmas song. And my father was in love with the piano players from Cuba, so he started getting me into transcription. Then I went on, started having a very... I worked since I was 12 years old. I decided to perform, playing bongos, actually. I started playing percussion. And I played with my father in a band where he was singing. As a matter of fact, I tricked him because he had a friend that was working at the Conservatory of Music that didn't know that my father has come back. Like, I made it seem like he was singing again. But my father was sort of like retired just to be with. And I got Papa on the scene again.
Oh, wow.
So, you know, I got myself on the bongos too, playing. And that's it. While I was doing that, I was going early in the morning to school. I was going midday to the conservatory to learn music, classical music. Mm-hmm. And at night, I would play with my father. So I had a very precocious life, you know, working late and playing.
Well, and it seems like such a family thing for you, your whole sort of musical education and experience and thinking. I mean, were you ever in like sort of bands with other kids?
No, actually not. It served the purpose to get closer to my father. We got to be really good friends through music. And my mother, she really gave me a lot of things in my life, like discipline and a lot of other respect. Thinking about the future, it was my mother, you know.
Right.
But my father was the one that really helped me to connect with music in a very, to speak the language of music as a universal language, actually.
He must be very proud of you.
He is, yeah. And I'm proud of him, too. He's actually a fantastic singer.
Is he?
Yeah, and I always admire him because he had a chance to come to New York in the 60s. And he decided to spend his life, you know, and the family, not trying to pursue a career. But he did really well in Panama. He's done really well. He has a career. So, I mean, we are planning to do a record together.
Oh, that's great.
He's got a fantastic voice, and he's a great bolero singer and Latin. In a Latin context, is amazing.
Yeah. Do you sing at all?
I can't sing in front of my father. I cannot sing. I would love to, actually. That's my
but
first love instrument.
But you can't sing in front of your father?
No.
Just, he's, you're not
my
gonna?
Papa is bad. No, no, no. You know what I mean? It's not possible. The other thing also, going back a little bit before, the electronic. I loved the electronic, and I was passionate about it, but it didn't last it. Long, you know, I was in the middle of a test, and I saw myself going, oh, my God, playing music. I saw people applauding. I had this daydream kind of thing.
Yeah.
And I quit. I had a test, and I
that
didn't do
it.
That's it. Right. I walk out. And.
But has that come in handy in any way to have a degree in electronics? I mean, just because of the musical world that we live in now?
Absolutely, absolutely. I think, you know, I've talked to Herbie about that because he studied electrical engineering, too. And I think, I mean, for me, it's helped me to teach myself a lot, to be self-sufficient at, you know, like analytical about things and putting 2 plus 2.
Yeah.
I mean, music, the intervallic experience is very similar in a way. And the frequencies, the vibrations, it's all mathematical. You know, geometry and all the all the things that I learned, algebra, they come very handy, actually. Mm-hmm. I mean, I still can depend on that as a way of learning, too.
Let me go back a little bit about as you were developing your career, and I know you were with Dizzy Gillespie for a while. You played with a number of just extraordinary jazz musicians. First of all, what was it like to be part of Dizzy's band? And I think you were the youngest member at the time?
Yes. Well, it was fascinating to be a part of that band. And I have to thank publicly, you know, people like Paquito de Rivera, Claudio Roditi, Sly Hanton, James Moody. People really, from early on, really gave me support to continue. Now, my experience previous to Dizzy was with a great singer, John Hendricks.
Oh.
And he, you know, that was a preparation to all of this, basically. Dizzy was, what I learned from Dizzy was basically a lot of things like humility. I mean, he really preached, you know, he wanted the teacher. There was a teacher in him to help people. The responsibility to give back, he felt it very strong. He was a natural. The one thing that struck me and resonated with me from where I came from Panama, which is very bio, you know, very global,
yeah.
In that way, the way we have grown up, is his approach to music was very global, you know, and he believed that through music, we can all come together. And that's sort of like has been my theme, and it will be until I rest, and, you know, until I die, that through music we can break all the boundaries. As a matter of fact, my mission now is to make music replace the passport.
The passport.
Yeah, we'll have a cultural passport, and we won't need immigration anymore. In the future.
Well, that's a fascinating concept, to say the least. A kind of global jazz passport, a global music passport.
Yeah, cultural. If you're part of the developing culture of the world in the goodness of humanity, you know, you don't have to go through it all. There'd be machines specifically for all the other people who are still looking for answers, you know, whatever.
Interesting.
You know, but what unites us in the world, it's all this beautiful music. Was a given. Music is one of the most beautiful things that humanity has recognized.
And so, is your life then all about music? I mean, is that what you do 24/7?
Music is what comes out, but what I really care the most is about how music affects society in positive way. Social transformation through music. This is my passion. This is what I've dedicated my 25 years in my country. I'm doing it now in Boston. And in Panama, I have a foundation. I created a festival called the Panama Jazz Festival, which all invited in January. It's cold here, so you can come down there.
It sounds good, actually.
But I dedicated that because I believe that when you have that kind of experience through music, you learn harmony, but not only the harmony of notes, you learn the harmony of life. You learn that we all connected, we all together, and that if everybody think positive and do just a little thing good, that will make a greater good. And in Panama, through music, we've seen it, the transformation of kid to kid. You know, you teach discipline, respect, you know, teamwork, hope, I mean, optimism. So many, you can affect culture, education, culture. You know what I mean? And I've dedicated to that. I've been a witness of that from early on in my life. You know, watching a guy coming and working in a washing machine that broke when I was 8 years old. He worked for 9 hours. My father and I were playing music.
Yeah.
And when he finished the work after 9 hours, my father said, "Take a shredded carrot and play the widow." And the guy did it. And after he did it, after 9 hours, he did it with us for an hour, you know, play more. And then my father said, "Okay, how much is the work that you did? How much do we have to pay you to fix the machine?" He said, "No, I have to pay you because I never felt this. That was the first time I saw the...
And you were a little boy at the time?
I was 8 years old. I said, oh, my God. And my father didn't even have to pay for the washing machine. The power of music, you know?
Indeed. And when you compose, are you at a computer? Are you at a keyboard? Are you at your kitchen table? How do you compose?
Wow. It doesn't... For me, comes like... You know, it comes. I've been in many different places.
the grocery store, maybe.
Yeah, the grocery store. I've been in a plane. I've been watching a boxing match. And, you know, I've been doing things, and an idea come in, and I run into a computer or into. Well, I'm. You know, I'm not. I'm just getting myself. I learned the basic of the computer. You know, I used to write very like the traditional way with the paper and all of that. And I find out pretty soon that I need to start making the big transition because, man, that takes a lot of time.
It does.
And with the computer, you can, you know. So I'm still making the transition to make it so I don't. It doesn't get in the way of the creative process. You know.
You live what, part time in is Boston your home now, or Massachusetts your home?
Yes, we are in Boston almost the whole year. Part time in Panama, we still have, you know, I have the foundation, the festival. My wife is in charge of the festival, and we are working in both places.
And do you see your children? I mean, obviously they're an inspiration for you.
You won't believe we're doing homeschooling.
You are.
Yeah.
As if you didn't have enough to do, right?
It's crazy.
Well,
that's,
weren't you? You were homeschooled, right?
So yeah, the first part of my life, the first, you know, 4 or 5 years old. That's what allows, the way we're doing homeschooling allows for a lot, even though my schedule is very, very busy, allows for us to really experience a lot of things together.
Right.
You know, because they schedule, we spend, you know, a lot of time when I'm around. And when I'm on touring, I always call them Skype, man. That's a great invention, yeah.
I'm curious, when you're performing and without a script, what is your head do? I mean, what are you thinking? Are you thinking? I'm just curious about how that works for you.
Yeah, not thinking process for me in that way. It's a quiet, at this moment in my life, it's very quiet, the place. And it's sort of like... you know, when you get in the water, for example, like you go in the ocean and you just open your arms and you start feeling the light, like the sun. The light comes in and you feel it like alive, like, wow. And, you know, it's almost like you recognize every part of your body that you probably have forgotten.
It's sort of almost like a hyper awareness and a calmness at the same time.
Exactly. It's a very powerful energy. And I feel very relaxed after. And I could play. I've done this, and I could play for hours.
Really?
And don't get tired.
I know. Wow.
You know what I mean?
Like
I could play like this, like that kind of intensity. We could play for hours and don't get tired.
It's been such a pleasure to have you with us on Radio Times. Thank you so much. We close out my 2010 interview with Danilo Perez with a title cut off of the album Providencia, which had been nominated for a Grammy just before his appearance on our show. This has been Radio Times in Review. I'm Marty Moscowane. Thank you for listening. You can email us and tell us what you think of Radio Times in Review at radiotimes@whyy.org. Radio Times is produced by Susan Greenbaum, Debbie Bilder, Emily Bryant, and John Ahrens. Thanks for joining us.